have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover this week, and with the inclusion of election endorsements.
Yeah, we're going to start out the half hour this morning with talking about the local elections. Are happening this year. The primary elections are happening this year in August, which means that folks who are receiving their ballots in the mail this weekend or early this coming week.
Actually, it's because a couple of people got them yesterday.
Yeah, I got mine yesterday. Those folks who may have planned for vacations in August, in early August, are sitting down right now and wanting to figure out how to vote and who to vote for. So we're starting our election endorsements this week for the primary. We're going to start off with the local races, first with the county council.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I should throw in the disclaimer before we get any farther. Maria is going to do most of this year for the simple reason that I'm working for a city council candidate, Diane Ferguson. And so I'm not really in a position to say a whole lot about a lot of these things for a couple of reasons. Number one, anything that I do say is strictly my own opinion. It is not a reflection of either Diane's opinion or the opinion of the campaign. But number two, because it's very easy to edit audio to not include that disclaimer, I also need to be very careful about what I say. So Maria is going to say it for me.
So enjoy that for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll just sit here and bite on my tongue until it bleeds, and you can. But Maria and I don't really disagree about a whole lot, but there might be things here and there. So
might be
anyway,
a couple things.
But I'll chip in, but I'm going to stay away. The other piece of it, of course, is because I've been on the campaign trail and interacting with some of these candidates, I know a lot of these folks personally, which has its advantages and disadvantages in terms of being able to give an objective assessment. So.
Okay.
All right.
So first off, we're going to talk about the county council. These days, the county council, King County Council, doesn't do a whole lot compared to what they used to do. They're through a series of budget cuts. About the only thing the county council does anymore is they oversee Metro Transit and cops and courts in the county. They don't provide the county doesn't provide any human services funding anymore, and there just isn't a whole lot outside those three things that they do. So in my mind, the big issue this year for the election races for the county is, where do these people stand on Metro bus service? That's the thing that impacts me the most, particularly since the city of Seattle has its own police force and its own courts. And less and less of the county is under county control when it comes to police and courts.
Yeah,
more and more of it is being incorporated into cities.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in my mind, Metro Transit really is what determines who I'm going to vote for this time around. In county council position number six, Richard Mitchell seems to be the choice of the establishment Democrats. Patsy Bonin-Contry is looking for a promotion from Bellevue City Council. She's currently a Bellevue City Council member. And John Crichton, who has spent many, many years at the port helping along.
Is it Crichton or Crichton?
I thought it was Crichton.
I think it's Crichton, but anyway.
But he's been at the port many years with a pro-business focus, helping to hand out taxpayer money for the businesses that use the port. And now he's looking for a step up to a bigger arena. Jane Haig is the incumbent. She's just been terrible.
Jane DUI Haig.
Yes, DUI Haig. She's been awful. So clearly you need to vote Haig out of office. We recommend Mitchell. He's really the only choice here, even though he is backed by the establishment Democrats. He's got to be better than Haig.
Yeah, Crichton or whatever it is, it's actually not been as bad on the Port of Seattle Council as many people were afraid he first might be, because he did come into the Port of Seattle with a lot of corporate backing. But he's not nearly as good as Mitchell. I totally concur with that.
And county council position number eight, given that good space guy isn't going to get any votes, you can certainly.
Sure about that.
Yeah, you can certainly wait until November, or you can make a choice now. You know, that leaves only two candidates, and in the primary, the top two candidates from each position will go to the final election in November. Either way, it's hard to tell which person to vote for here. I think the difference here is in experience. Diana Toledo really looks very like she has no experience and is rather naive about how the political process works. She talks a lot about Democrats and Republicans getting along, yada, yada. She doesn't seem to have a whole lot of positions to talk about or understanding of the issues, which I think means if she were elected, she would be anybody's to influence and control. So in my mind, Joe McDermott, at least he has come out and said that he's a strong supporter of Metro Transit and of extending light rail. He's also one of the votes on the city council who would vote to put the $20 car tab fee.
County council.
On the county council, yeah, who would vote for the $20 car tab fee. And so in my mind, he's the guy you should vote for, even though he's the incumbent. So Joe McDermott for position number 8. For Court of Appeals, Division 1, District 1, there's only one candidate, Michael Spearman. He was appointed by Governor Gregoire, and now he's looking for confirmation from the voters for some additional time in that position. And, you know, when you look at his qualifications, he seems like a pretty good guy, so I wouldn't mind voting for him. Oftentimes, we recommend that folks skip a race because out of principle, if there's only one candidate, that every race ought to have more than one candidate. But in this case, I think Spearman looks like a good guy, so you're free to ink his bubble if you want. City council positions, there's two city council positions up for grabs this year. Gene Godden is one.
In the primary. There'll actually be five in November.
In the final,
But three of those races now only have two candidates. It's the two that have multiple candidates, more than two, that are on the ballot
that have
in August,
to be decided.
Right.
And one of those is Gene Godden's position number 1. And I think just about everybody around town, not just us, but the Seattle Times and the PI, just about everybody has said that it's time to replace Godden. It was time to replace Godden during the last time she ran for this position.
She should never have been elected in the first place, but that's another story.
That's another story.
It happened. We got to deal with the damage and move on.
Yeah. And in this case, there are three candidates against her. One is Maurice Claussen. He's the one who has been getting a lot of press. He has a lot of money. He's got a lot of backing from people who formerly backed Gene Godden to be originally elected for this position. And
in other words, downtown and business establishment.
Yes, and in most respects, Claussen's positions on the issues are not much different from what Godden's are. He's just basically a younger male version of her. And the other two candidates, you have Michael Taylor Judd and Bobby Forch. Bobby Forch looks good because
it's Forch, I believe.
He comes to the race with a platform on police accountability issues that no other candidate has put forward. Nobody is even talking about what is one of the biggest issues that the city needs to deal with and needs to deal with soon.
Actually, Diane Ferguson's been talking a lot about it too, but very few other people have.
But very few other people have, yeah. And in this race, Forch is the only one who has been talking about that. On the other hand, you have Michael Taylor Judd, who is the only candidate who has mentioned any kind of transportation issues, particularly he's anti-tunnel. And with that being one of the main issues that the city council has been dealing with, I lean towards Michael Taylor Judd. On the other hand, if you feel like you want to vote for a candidate that has a chance to go on to the final, you may want to vote for Bobby Forch. Either one is good. So Michael Taylor Judd or Bobby Forch. For position number 9, I'd say Diane Ferguson by a mile, for no other reason than that Sally Clark, I think, should be punished for saying in her voters pamphlet statement that she's the leading voice on the council for affordable housing. I just want to ask her.
Although that is a low bar.
Yeah. I just want to ask her, is she really talking about the city of Seattle when she mentions the word affordable housing? As far as I can tell, she's really referring to her support for one or two projects that would produce market rate housing, not affordable housing. That might be affordable for someone who makes above median income, but for those of us who make median income or below, there is simply very, very little affordable rate housing in the city of Seattle, and it's rapidly disappearing.
Yeah, the one thing that Clark has been talking about a lot on the campaign trail is her support for or the inclusion of an affordable housing rider for a project south of Pioneer Square that's going to have a huge number of of new units. But the thing is, the way the city council defines affordable housing is 80% of median income. And so you wind up with this, dynamic where you can get $1,200-$1,300 for a studio or a one bedroom apartment. That's considered affordable, which is not.
Yeah. And these projects are not required to produce 100% affordable housing units in their projects. They're just required to produce a small number within the larger projects. So only six units in a much larger project may be, you know, for people who make 80% of median income. That's not encouraging affordable housing. It's encouraging developers to build housing that's market rate and above, and throw in a few studio apartments for students and call it good. That's not support for affordable housing in my mind.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not going to give the whole rap on this race that I very easily
could. Oh, no,
could.
I know that, Josh.
But I will say that this is the first time in, you know, 15 or so years of being around local political elections that I felt moved to work for a candidate. So, mm-hmm. I'm pretty biased on this one.
And, you know, Sally Clark has a reputation for not having a reputation. Nobody really knows who she is. Nobody knows what she does. And she's been on the council long enough that she should have some kind of a reputation. Folks should recognize her name and should know what she's done. And most of the time when you mention Sally Clark, they say, who's that? You have to remind them that she's on city council, because she mostly votes with the majority. She very rarely takes a stand on issues. She voted for the anti-panhandling ordinance, which in my mind, again, should be another reason to kick her off the council.
And her chief of staff is on loan this summer, so he can help run the pro-tunnel campaign.
Yeah, so that shows you what her positions are, and it is time to replace her. So that wraps up our campaign endorsements for this week. Next week, we're going to talk about the school board, and we're going to talk about the referendums.
And there's a cheat sheet that's already up at www.eatthestate.org, and over the weekend or Monday, we'll have the full endorsement article up, so you can refer to that then.
Yeah, so in case you're going on vacation next week and need to know what our recommendations are before then, you should check out our website this weekend, and we'll have the full list of campaign endorsements up there.
All right. Moving on to some election-related news.
Yeah, there was some elections-related news this week, particularly surrounding Referendum 1, the referendum to approve or reject the tunnel. The Let's Move Forward folks, those are the anti-Referendum 1 folks, raised $216,000 this week alone, bringing their total for their campaign up to $312,000. Their biggest contributions this week came from three companies who are tunnel contractors. Dragados USA and Tudor Perini both gave the pro-tunnel campaign $25,000 each, and HNTB, an engineering firm with a tunnel contract, gave them $10,000, which raised this issue of, isn't that a little bit of a conflict of interest? Well,
It's the American political system. What's your problem with that?
The Protect Seattle Now folks said, yes, we think that's a conflict of interest, even if it's not prohibited by the city's ethics and elections rules. But the Let's Move Forward folks said, "Oh no, it just shows that these folks are partners in business with the city of Seattle, and they care about the direction of the city, yada 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 yada." But it clearly, in my mind, means these guys are giving money to get money, so not content with just out raising funds and outspending the anti-tunnel crew, the Let's Move Forward folks filed a complaint with the Seattle Ethics and Election Commission this week that Protect Seattle Now had put out a brochure that
and Protect Seattle is the anti.
Yeah, folks. The Protect Seattle folks are the anti-tunnel campaign crew, that they put out a brochure that's nearly identical to one put out by Mike McGinn during his run for mayor. Now, if you look at the two brochures, I have to argue with that because, in my mind, they don't look anything alike. It's very clear to me that the brochure that was done by the Mike McGinn campaign is very professional, very slick looking. The brochure that was done by the Protect Seattle Now campaign looks like it was pretty quickly slapped together, which, as it turns out, when Publicola called up the campaign manager for Protect Seattle Now, it turns out that, yes, it was put together by a young volunteer with a laptop. and a couple of extra hours of time. And so that hasn't stopped the pro-tunnel folks from going after Protect Seattle now. They're clearly trying to disrupt their campaign by filing this frivolous complaint with Seattle Ethics and Elections.
And they're also trying to tie it to McGinn, who's polling very badly in the polls right now by putting that meme out that, you know, McGinn's cooperating with the anti-tunnel campaign.
Yeah.
This is all about him, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
That's a part of what that's about.
That's a big part of what that's about. They're trying to kind of use McGinn's unpopularity to make the anti-tunnel campaign unpopular as well.
So is that illegal to use a similar format to someone else who's?
No, it is not illegal.
Happens all the time.
It is not illegal. Right. And well, in fact, in the complaint, the Let's Move Forward people said, well, part of the, you know, part they cited as part of the reason that the brochures had to be identical is because they covered the same themes. Well, no kidding. Mike McGinn ran on an anti-tunnel campaign. The Protect Seattle Now folks are supporting a referendum that is against the tunnel. I mean, of course the themes are going to be the same. They can't get away from that.
Have you ever seen a mailing from a judicial campaign that did not talk about the themes yet fair?
Yes, the themes are all the same.
Let's do it for the kids.
Yeah, the themes are all the same.
All right.
So it's a ridiculous thing.
All right. Let's move on. Still plenty to cover. Sick leave.
Yeah, the Downtown Seattle Association and the Greater Seattle Chamber of Commerce got together this week. I'm sure they often get together in the smoke-filled rooms. But they got together and they wrote a letter to the city council this week. And the letter was about the paid sick leave ordinance that's under consideration by the city council. And, you know, the Downtown Seattle Business Association and the Chamber of Commerce, they complained about how, oh, this is going to severely impact businesses, and particularly businesses that have 1,000 or more employees. You know, it's going to be expensive for them to do this, et cetera, et cetera. It's an economic downturn, you know, whiny, whiny, whiny. But the problem with that, is that is just not a persuasive argument. We're talking about a time when U.S. corporations right now are sitting on a record amount of cash. They have enormous cash, historically, right now, enormous cash reserves that are not being spent on anything. And that money has to be freed up to help the economy. Right now, the only way the economy is going to recover, our national economy, our local economy, you name it, the only way the economy is going to recover is if we free up cash and redistribute it throughout the system so that folks from whom that cash was taken in the first place have some money to spend to get the economic engine going again. So barring a complete change in the way our economy functions or a complete change in our type of economy, this is the only thing that is going to help. And paid sick leave is a very, very good way to free up cash. It would force employers to use their cash to pay a little bit more in wages to their lowest paid employees. It would give the folks who need money to spend. And once that money gets spent in the economy, it would help businesses all across the board. So paid sick leave is one very great way to do this redistribution.
And not only that, but in places like San Francisco where it has been done, there has not been a negative effect on corporate bottom lines.
Yeah,
it's just not sustained by experience.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to be against it.
All right. Moving on to a couple of transportation items, starting with the King County Council. In a vote they did this week, or lack thereof.
Yeah, King County Council was supposed to decide on Monday whether to put the $20 car tabs on the ballot in November. This in addition to the $80 that the City Council has already decided to put on the ballot in November. And the King County Council decided to punt for a couple of weeks until August 15th. They couldn't make up their mind. And the problem with this is that they need a supermajority of 6 out of the 9 votes to comply with the Iman initiative from last year for any kind of an increase in order to just automatically go ahead and raise the car tabs. They can do it with a simple majority, 5 out of the 9 votes, in order to put it on the ballot in November.
Not anymore. If they had made the decision at their last meeting, it would have required 5 out of 9. Now that they delayed it, it's going to require 6 out of 9, according to their rules.
Yeah, well, I was going to get
uh-huh,
to that.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, they say they have the 6 out of 9 to put it on the ballot.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it's an exercise in political cowardice that they didn't just pass it in the first place, because as we've talked about on this show, the cuts that have been proposed for Metro, if they don't get that funding, are absolutely devastating in terms of bus routes all over the city and all over the county. So we'll see what they do, but, at this point, we have a couple of weeks to lobby county council to do the right thing.
And I just want to point out too that they made this decision after sitting through 3 hours of testimony at their last county council meeting. They called a recess, went back, you know, into a room and just came back and said, "Oh no, we're not going to decide for another 2 weeks." And you know, mid-August is when most people are on vacation or they're in the middle of
which is the whole point,
summer plans. Yeah, and waiting 2 weeks and waiting until the last minute, because August 15th is the last day that they could decide on the issue before, you know,
the deadline
passes for them to put it on the ballot. They're doing it. They're delaying because they're hoping the public uproar will die down and that they'll be able to sneak a vote to either defeat it or to either punt it to the voters, and nobody will blame them for it.
Here's
and
the prediction.
I just
it
find
won't.
It, yeah, and I just find that to be extremely, not just cowardly, but extremely cowardly.
All right, let's move on. Mm-hmm. Sound Transit.
Yeah, this week the Sound Transit Board agreed to a light rail alignment for the East Side Light Rail expansion. Now, there's been a lot of back and forth between Sound Transit and the Bellevue City Council over the preferred alignment for light rail. The Bellevue City Council has, which is mostly representative of the Bellevue business community. The Bellevue City Council has preferred an expensive tunnel through downtown Bellevue. And for the area south of downtown, they've wanted the light rail line to run through the Mercer Slough, the sort of nature preserve where no one lives. It would be extremely expensive to build a safe and easy to maintain, light rail line through there.
Yeah, it's a wetland.
It is essentially a wetland. And Sound Transit has wanted to move the south alignment over to firmer ground, shall we say, and they have wanted to do a surface option through most of downtown Bellevue. And this week the Sound Transit folks reached an agreement that would have been a compromise. They decided not to run it through the Mercer Slough, to run it on firmer ground south of downtown, but they decided to vote for a tunnel through Bellevue, which adds a total of $100 to $200 million to the budget for light rail on the east side. And that $100 to $200 million does not yet have a funding source. Two board members voted against this alignment, particularly because of the downtown Bellevue tunnel. One of them was King County Council member Larry Phillips, and the other, I bet you can guess, was Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn.
All right. Moving on, activist victory this week.
Yeah, good news, and we don't get enough of this, so it's something to talk about. It actually, the change came in last month, but it came to light this week. SPD has made a change in response to several years of actually activist agitation in the way that it tickets and gives warnings to people, particularly homeless people, who are trespassing, for instance, sleeping in a doorway overnight. And the old policy, the way SPD would do it, is they could bar you from that property, even if that property had, say, a food bank or a shelter or something like that on it. You then could not use that property. Now the way they've got it set up is that they would ban you, and it was totally up to the officer, even if you had the permission of the property owner to be on that property. Now it's based on the property owner, and the ban letters, if they do happen, do not apply to any services that are within the property. So it's very much an improvement in the quality of life for homeless folks in particular who have to use these services. And shows you what you can do if just one or two people identify a need like that and start working through the bureaucracy to make it happen. And kudos to SPD for finally doing the right thing and changing their policy.
All right. Let's move on to national and the debt ceiling.
Yeah, the debt ceiling. I don't want to belabor the point too much because we don't have a whole lot of time left. But the deadline is August 2nd, coming up on this Tuesday. And just as a reminder, now that as of last night, the Senate has rejected the House of Representatives Republican proposal, as everybody knew that they would, we are in a wholly artificial crisis created by intransigent Republicans who don't want to take yes for an answer. And if this goes away, and it probably will at some point in the next few days, but if this goes away without there'll be some sort of government shutdown, but there'll be a question at this point is how extensive and how much and what a impact it will be on the economy. The issue is not going to go away, because after this, we're going to move right into the 2012 budget debate, and we're going to get exactly the same sorts of demands from Republicans. So this is just going to keep happening and keep happening and keep happening until some of these folks are voted out, or until the economy tanks so badly that these people are shamed into not inflicting this kind of damage on the national and global economy.
I think the people we're talking about wouldn't acknowledge that a failing economy had anything to do with their not agreeing on a raising the debt ceiling.
Well, they're not acknowledging policy. They're not acknowledging
because they don't
objective reality in the
exactly,
first place.
Because they're
it's magical thinking.
Because they don't live in the same world we do. I want to talk a little bit about what the impact of a default would be. The impact of a default, which looks increasingly likely, is, of course, higher interest rates. First, people with home equity loans, business loans, credit cards, auto loans, and student loans that have been made to them by private banks would see their interest rates rise. Secondarily, folks with adjustable rate mortgages would see their interest rates eventually rise. And, of course, those students who receive their student loans from the government could also see their interest rates rise, although it would take longer for those two folks, adjustable rate mortgages and government-issued student loans. That would come a little bit after the initial wave of interest rate increases. So most folks, home equity loans, credit cards, auto loans, student loans made by private banks, and business loans would all see their interest rates rise and their payments on their credit cards would have to increase. Also, we'd see volatility in stock and bond markets while investors run around the world searching for a combination of safety and high return. We'd also see interest rates in general, as they rise, we'd also see inflation increase because businesses would have to charge more for their products and services in order to cover payments on their own debts. We would see a higher deficit at the federal level because the federal government has to pay its debts and its interest rates would go up.
And remember, that's the whole point of this in the first place, supposedly, is to try and reduce the deficit.
Yes, exactly. And we would see problems for state and local governments. They also have bonds they have to pay. Their interest rates would increase. This includes your school board, your school districts. They have bonds that they issue and they have interest that they have to pay. Their interest rates would go up as well. And you would see lower and states and local governments would have a double whammy because they would have lower tax revenue as consumers have to make more payments on their debt. And as businesses have to make more payments on their debt and don't raise people's salaries, then that means less tax collection, and there's less people spending money and paying sales tax. That's less tax collections for state and local governments. So at the very time when their interest rates go up, their tax revenue would go down. So we'd see even more budget cuts at the state and local level. So that's what the Tea Party Republicans are risking by not negotiating in a reasonable way on raising the debt ceiling.
Not just risking, but virtually guaranteeing.
Yes.
All right. Events.
Yeah, several events coming up this week. Today there is a Medicare birthday party trying to advocate for Medicare for All and universal health care. That will be from noon to 2 p.m. starting at the southwest entrance of Safeco Field, and then they're going to march north through downtown, and by God, they're not going to stop marching until they get universal health care, which means they'll be marching about 100 miles to the border. Monday, August 1st at 4 p.m., there will also be a rally that will be to reject the tunnel in advance of the primary vote, of course, that's coming up. That will be at Alaska and King Street underneath the viaduct, assuming, of course, that the viaduct has not collapsed by Monday. And then, of course, on Wednesday, August 3rd, as is is the case most every year. Seafair is bringing in military vessels from the U.S. Navy as part of its Seafair fleet demonstration for Fleet Week. And so the Peace Fleet will be there to meet them and to protest the military connection to Seafair. That will be at 1 o'clock at Pier 66 and then out on the water in Elliott Bay as well.
And that's Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
As Maria mentioned, the cheat sheet for the Eat the State endorsements is online now, and we will have the full endorsement article along with several other features up in the next couple days. That's at www.eatthestate.org.